Welcome to 35 West. I'm Chris Hernandez-Roy, Deputy Director of the Americas Program at CSIS and co-host of the 35 West podcast.
With how professional the Mexican
but
government
are we ready? I don't
reform
think.
Trends in Argentina.
Right. And that's what happened.
Role at all in the NAFTA negotiation.
Good morning. Thank you for joining us today in this Twitter space conversation on Latin American fighters in Ukraine. I'm Chris Hernandez-Roy, Deputy Director and Senior Fellow of the Americas Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Citizens from Latin America have played a role in the conflict stemming from Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine as foreign fighters for both sides. Neither Moscow nor Kyiv publish exact data on the number or nationality of Latin American fighters who join their ranks, but estimates range from several hundred to more than 1,000 fighters total spread across each front. Joining me today are Elizabeth Grassmeter and André Servin to discuss this little-known aspect of the conflict as the war enters its third year. Dr. Grassmeter is an adjunct professor of practice, national security at Duke University. Her research examines the composition of modern militaries, covert action, and conflict. Dr. Servin is the president of CRIES, a center for social and economic studies based in Buenos Aires. He specializes in open source intelligence analysis on Latin America. In September, Havana claimed to have cracked down on deceptive Russian recruiters operating on the island, arresting 17 in connection to what it described in a statement as human trafficking, and that, quote, Cuba plays no role in the war in Ukraine, unquote. However, the country's ambassador to Moscow later told state media that, quote, we have nothing against Cubans who just want to sign a contract and legally take part in this operation, unquote. Journalists who have interviewed Cuban fighters suggest that they receive little to no training before being sent to the front lines. Some claim to have been lured to Russia for lucrative construction jobs, only to be sent to the trenches in Ukraine in pursuit of salaries more than 100 times those of ordinary Cubans. What factors explain why Russia has turned to recruiting Cubans? How can we understand Cuba's apparent crackdown on Russian recruitment schemes?
Hi, everyone. Well, thank you for the invitation. Glad to be participating. I think this is quite a heated debate, right? Once the news came out about this human trafficking accusation by the Cubans, it brought about a lot of questions regarding how the Russians are recruiting, and it also kind of confirmed some of the previous indications that we had seen about Cubans actually fighting on the Russian side. And I think that when we get into further discussion, like how the recruitment happens for these types of, whether either side of the fighting sides, we're going to notice that there's two main explanations. And one has to do with the supply side, right? When you have personnel that's willing to go out to fight, that is looking for better wages, new job opportunities, and that may lure them in. Whether those motivations or the promises that are made to them are real or not, there's that side in Latin America in general where wages are low when there's not necessarily good job opportunities. So we see that being a very attractive aspect of joining one of the sides in fighting in the Ukraine conflict, right? I don't know if we want to get Elizabeth in on this now.
Yes, please. Elizabeth, would you care to give us your perspective on why Russia has turned to Cubans?
Sure. So having looked at about 250 of these policies, there are two camps of countries that pursue these policies to recruit foreigners into their militaries, these foreign legionnaires. And you actually see both in the ongoing Russia-Ukraine conflict. First, you have countries like Ukraine that do so as a part of a bid to ensure national survival. This is when they face invasion, the prospect of dismemberment, and they undertake this effort to get as many bodies, foreign or citizen, into the military to safeguard the state. Russia encapsulates the second group of countries. These are situations wherein governments are balancing between two competing imperatives. On the one hand, you've got battlefield dynamics that stoke this need for manpower of some kind. Things like territorial losses, attrition of troops, a more dogged defender than was anticipated, which Russia is certainly seeing in Ukraine. So all of these security dynamics that mean a soldier of some kind has to be found and maintained. But on the other hand, they face competing imperatives in the form of domestic politics. While we tend to think of countries as having these unlimited abilities to mobilize their citizenry for soldiers, governments like Putin's can actually face real political and even security risks in doing so. So when governments face the prospect of mass unrest, such as anti-conscription protests in Russia, the prospect of a coup or recent leadership overthrow attempt, Wagner's rebellion certainly comes to mind, or other dynamics like sectarian cleavages or a tight labor market, there can be real political and even security risks if governments mine the citizenry too heavily for soldiers. So in these contexts, governments like Russia turn to foreigners. They recruit these legionnaires as a part of this balancing act between the number of citizen soldiers they think they can safely mobilize and the number of soldiers they need on the battlefield.
Andrei, the New York Times has reported that there are likely hundreds of Colombian volunteers in Ukraine at any given time, fighting on the side of Ukraine. Given its long internal conflict, the country has a history of exporting experienced soldiers abroad to serve as private military contractors, so this makes sense. Why is it that so many Colombians have volunteered to join the conflict? How does involvement in the war in Ukraine compare to other conflicts that Colombian veterans have been involved in?
Well, one thing that we have to point out, and you kind of mentioned this, is that historically, there's been like a disproportionate amount of Colombians fighting in private military companies across the world. And this has to do both with like an internal tendency, especially from many decades ago, with the proliferation of private military enterprises in Colombia, as well as this growing demand internationally, especially after the 2000s, for having capable, trained personnel that can be taken abroad to fulfill this task, right? So this is a bit more on the demand side, but on the supply side, we have to remember that Colombia, after Brazil, it's the second largest military in terms of manpower in the region. And it's putting out around 10,000 people that are retiring every year. So there's a huge amount of retired military personnel from Colombia that's going out into the job market. And part of that is absorbed by a lot of these local national private military companies in Colombia. Others try to insert themselves in other areas. But as we all know, and this is a big debate in many countries, many times demobilized veterans reinserting themselves into the job market is particularly difficult. And there you have these large groups of trained personnel who have these capacities and that have a lot of value in the international market. And that's why historically we've seen a lot of Colombians going abroad and getting these types of jobs. And Ukraine has not been the exception to this. Quite on the contrary, we've seen, along with Brazilians, which is also the other large group that we see of Latin Americans fighting on the Ukrainian side, Colombians have been very important in terms of numbers for Ukrainians. And here, I think there's other elements that are very important to highlight in understanding why it's not just about how many Colombians are available to go out and fight, but also how recruitment is many times aimed at soldiers who have a profile like the Colombians. So Colombians, many times people, analysts highlight that they're battle hardened. They have actual combat experience. And this is quite true. They've been through decades of armed conflict. Very different conflict, though, right? Because we're usually talking about low-intensity asymmetric warfare in Colombia and not the high-intensity peer-on-peer type of conflict that we're seeing in Ukraine. But on the other side, when we look back at the history of the development of the armed forces in Colombia, especially with Plan Colombia, the United States has poured billions of dollars in assistance to Colombia. And not a small part of that, a rather large part of that, has been specifically directed into training, especially training special forces units in Colombia. So these personnel that are retiring coming out of the Colombian Armed Forces many times either have been part of special forces units and have also that battle experience. But on top of that, many of them have been trained by U.S. instructors. So that becomes very relevant for them in terms of how they get to be profiled on the job market, right? And if you put this together with Colombia also being a global partner for NATO, that brings in other elements that have to do on the technical side and on the operational side that really facilitate the integration of the specialized personnel into units in Ukraine. So I think that that's why we see this, what seems like a disproportionate amount of Colombians fighting in Ukraine or in PMCs around the world compared to what is their actual population within Latin America. But it ends up being explained because we have a huge amount of them coming out of the armed forces and they possess traits that are highly requested in Ukraine or in other places.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Can you could just add for a minute or two, you mentioned that there was also a good amount of Brazilians fighting in Ukraine. Could you enlighten our listeners a little bit more about that topic?
It's been interesting to see from the beginning of the conflict 2 years ago, we started seeing the presence of a lot of Brazilians, especially through social media, right? It's quite easy to identify a Brazilian when they're fighting, you know, with the Portuguese, right? And there was a lot of indicators of social media that brought up a lot of attention. There's some research that has been done into how the Brazilians are reaching Ukraine and fighting there. And I think that it's been a bit less of a systematic recruitment process. And a lot of them have been volunteers that have paid for their own expenses to be able to get to Ukraine from Brazil. So paying for their airline tickets and documentation and just being able to make it to Ukraine and fight. So that has to do, I think that there's also an element of different motivations there. And Brazilians have become an important number, at least from the anecdotal data that we can pick up from social media, right? Because, of course, the numbers, when we're looking at a lot of these units that operate with foreign fighters, are very sketchy or hard to define.
In August of last year, two Venezuelan dissidents co-founded the Bolivar Battalion, a group open to anyone from Spanish-speaking countries and, quote, other free-thinking and democratic citizens of the world who feel close to us. This is a quote from the Bolivar Battalion. Formally integrated under the umbrella of Ukraine's Ministry of Defense, the battalion uses social media, as you've just mentioned a minute ago. This is a tool used a lot in this case, to highlight the close military and economic ties between the Maduro and Putin regimes that fuel Russia's war effort. Elizabeth, to what extent do Latin American fighters see common cause with the Ukrainian struggle against Russian authoritarianism? Maybe that's part of the motivation for these Brazilians that Andre was just mentioning a minute ago. How does the Bolivar Battalion compare to other instances of ideologically driven foreign involvement in other conflicts?
So I think certainly, as Andres described and others know, there's quite a bit of common cause. Certainly the way in which Ukraine's fight against Russia has embodied this kind of moral struggle between democracy and autocracy, between national protection and self-determination versus Russian imperial ambition, as well as the structures of international power, autocrats helping autocrats, that keep folks like Maduro in power. All of those are very compelling reasons that this would motivate folks to volunteer, just as Andre and others have described. But it's also very clear how those common cause and that overlapping philosophy very much makes the situation in Ukraine reminiscent of profoundly important other examples, wherein governments have used these foreigners to really important ends. Perhaps the most apt comparison is how Britain leveraged American pilots, Polish pilots, allied governments in exile as really the backbone of the country's defense when it was standing alone against Nazi Germany in 1940. And so there are benefits on both sides. The exiles who get recruited, so like Venezuelans in Ukraine now or the Poles in World War II, there are a few very obvious benefits. It keeps their cause alive and in the spotlight internationally. It conveys this grounds for continued hope that we're seeing in the international stage, that we're seeing acting as a government-like actor, and that we're doing so on the side of the right. So kind of accruing that greater moral credit as to why eventually foreign allies, the United States, others, should come on the side of these individuals in exile who are fighting. It can also be an opportunity to find common cause with others, just as the Venezuelans in exile fighting for Ukraine. There are also anti-Putin Russians who are doing the same. The degree to which those kind of common movements can build connections and fuel each other's and find ways to be successful, that's invaluable social currency. But on the side of the recruiting government, there's also this benefit. When you have actors, particularly those that wish to be democratic in an autocratic context, Poles taken over by Soviet Union and Germany in World War II, Venezuelans now, it also shows a lot of international legitimacy. It's not just Ukraine's fight against Russia, it's the world's fight. It's the world democratic powers fight. And showing itself to be allied with these other underdogs can also create this very compelling narrative that if you support us, you also have to support these other units. And it becomes this great backdoor way to exert political pressure on Western governments, the United States with our issues in Congress, those of the European Union. It can keep them from wanting to quietly withdraw from the conflict. Because doing so means not only denying their support to Ukraine, but also to these other movements they're so supposed to ostensibly support.
That's fascinating, Elizabeth. I'm wondering, this issue of keeping grounds for hope and common cause, this question is to either of you. One can see that the Bolivar Battalion, Venezuelans fighting a common enemy. Is there evidence of foreign fighters from countries, other dictatorships in the region? We've already talked about Cuba. What about Nicaragua? Is there any evidence that the Nicaraguans are fighting on the side of the Russians or other nationalities fighting on either side? Andre, maybe I could direct that question to you.
Sure. I'm not sure. I haven't seen that much evidence of clear instances of that, but I do kind of have a follow-up question to Elizabeth that might help clear this up too as well, right? Because when we see the foundation of the Bolivar Battalion and we've seen the numbers grow of some of the other countries in the region, like Argentina. But I remember in the first months of the war, when this was a big part of the subject, right, the foreign fighters going into Ukraine, a comment that was very common amongst people that were trying to get to Ukraine and fight, especially from Venezuela at the time, as well as Argentina, that was still under the president, Alberto Fernandez, is they were not being able to make it through the veto process into the armed forces of Ukraine, right? Because they were saying, no, you're coming from countries that are politically aligned or inclined towards Russia. So there's like this veto process. So I'm wondering if the creation of, you know, like Bolivar Battalion is also intended to help streamline that vetoing process to make sure that the people who are going into these units are not either leaning towards the Venezuelan government, for example, and therefore could be agents that are working in favor of Russia or something like that. I don't know if you have specific knowledge on that, but just occurred to me as you were talking, if it also has to do with a bit more of that bureaucratic process behind being able to integrate foreign fighters.
I think that's actually very well said, Andre. The idea that these standalone units that kind of examine or vet their co-nationals or co-ethnics, that's very much kind of, it can speed the process or perhaps ferret out individuals who could be counterintelligence CI threats, who could be just attempting to get skills that they can then switch to the other side. It can also certainly help with things like quite a few Colombians or Venezuelans who are trained in a common military culture and framework, they can operate as a cohesive unit. So there are benefits on multiple sides. It's also perhaps striking that, as you mentioned, Ukraine was able, given the influx of volunteers early in the war, to maintain quite high standards. Only seasoned veterans apply. But it has also, I think, in the past year, stood up an entire website in Spanish just to recruit individuals from Latin America or for countries that have a large Spanish-speaking population, because it's seeing the value not only of having a long pipeline, people who perhaps they're not useful now, but they can be trained with those Colombian U.S. trained veterans or by foreign forces in the ground, keeping that pipeline going. And it's also a way to keep important constituencies across the so-called Global South or the non-aligned bloc and keep their voices heard and keep their interest, a kind of way of denying to Russia the ability to paint that, look, this entire bloc of Latin American countries is on our side. Well, the governments may be in some cases, but the people are voting with their feet and they're taking those feet to join the Ukrainian military. So I think that's very well said. And as to the question about individuals from other autocracies joining the Ukrainian side, I've certainly seen onesies and twosies of claims. Nicaragua has come up a couple of times, but Andre will know far better the veracity of those reports. But I will say also, much like the Venezuelans, there are individuals healing from autocratic governments or transitioning governments that perhaps still have further to go in their respect for human rights. They've also joined the Ukrainian cause. You've seen that from the Balkans. You've seen that from Central Asia, you know, other theaters of the world where the very themes that the Venezuelans and Bolivar Battalion are themselves raising. So I think it just speaks to how globally resonant that kind of activity is.
Andre, you've written extensively on the responses from Latin American governance to Russia's war in Ukraine, including the war's economic impact and the use of Russian disinformation to favorably shape the narrative around the war. Many Latin American countries are in possession of Russian-supplied armed Soviet legacy weapons, including large stocks of munitions, helicopters, and in fact, even jets, which most Ukrainian troops are already familiar with and can use. But these governments have refused to aid either side. Recently elected Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa agreed just 2 months ago, well, I guess in January 2024, to transfer what Colombian President Petro had called Russian scrap to the U.S. for use in Ukraine in exchange for $200 million worth of newer American equipment as that country faces an acute security crisis. That was, however, until Russia imposed a ban on Ecuadorian banana exports to Russia worth about $800 million a year. And so Noboa reversed course. And we know that Venezuela has been building Iranian military drones for more than a decade. And there is some evidence that they may be supplying Russia with either drones or parts And Trey, can we expect any Latin American governments to consider providing support to either Russia or Ukraine, material support, that is, in the coming months or years? Or is this pretty much a dead end at this point?
I think that the first part of what you mentioned kind of helps us understand that the likelihood of having actual supplies coming from Latin America into either side of the conflict is low, because one of the main problems that most of the South American militaries are suffering is lack of capacities, material capacities, right? There's a whole lot of problems in the armed forces in the region having to do with budgets and personnel and logistics and infrastructure and everything. But part of it is maintaining operational and capable and modern material. And sometimes that's what makes it tempting for countries like Ecuador, or in the case of Argentina. Argentina, as soon as Milei took office, offered to transfer two Russian-made helicopters that were non-operational because, well, Russia had not provided proper logistical support since 2021. So even from before the war, they're already having problem with the post-sale support from the Russians to maintain the helicopters, right? So it becomes, at first, a very tempting offer, but then you have the small print and the other political consequences. So in the case of Ecuador, well, we have the $800 million in banana exports that go towards Russia. It's kind of sad that we're going back to being pushed around because of banana productions, but I guess it has to do with cycles in our region. But it's hard today when we're talking about $200 worth of new military equipment. Well, $200 million doesn't get you all that far nowadays, right? And Ecuador is finding itself also in the middle of a huge internal crisis, and it's requiring all types of hardware. So I think that the offer sometimes also, it falls short because the commercial consequences can be very big, but also because maybe the benefits that could be brought in directly through the importation of new material provided by the States or Europe might also be limited. And I think that that has a bit of an impact. And we're seeing, like, there's other countries in the region that could have provided military hardware to Ukraine. And we're thinking, let's talk about Brazil, for example. They have the Mi-35 fleet that they've been operating for a few years. They're unsatisfied with them. They've been wanting to replace them, yet they're not willing to make the transfer because of the political implications that has. And going back to the case of Argentina that I was mentioning before, just 2 days ago, the Foreign Affairs Minister, Mondino, said, let's not let the war in Ukraine affect the commercial relations with Russia. And this is from a government that had taken a very harsh stance on Russian invasion of Ukraine, who had discussed what we said before about transferring the helicopters, and now seeing that, well, the possible economic consequences of taking those political measures are very high, and they're probably not best suited for the current conditions in these countries. So I think that at least in terms of direct support to Ukraine, it's going to be a bit more difficult. I think that there are some opportunities. I feel like they're going to be missed. So for example, you have countries like Argentina who have been making an effort with the previous government and this one to try and reinstate ammunition production capacity, right? Argentina is one of the few countries in the region that has actually produced 155-millimeter artillery ammunition in the past and still has that capacity, although a bit obsolete. And that could be a really easy way to get production started, lower the cost for Argentina in acquiring this ammunition while also being willing to transfer some of it. Now, even not necessarily directly to Ukraine, they could transfer it to another European country. But the political domestic cost of wanting to reactivate the debate regarding arms exports is too high, right? So the likelihood of that happening is quite low. And then the last mention on Venezuela, I think that Venezuela is an example of a country that has been pushing to establish these capacities of local production. And they fail miserably once the external support is gone, right? So they've been making huge strides to build these Iranian drones in Venezuela. And at most, what they've been able to do is import parts and assemble them. And they have not been able to fully establish local production capacities, right? And they're dependent on not just the Iranian parts, but also other off-the-shelf parts that they get from the commercial market. Or another example, you know, since around 12 years ago, the AK factory and ammunition factory in Gabin should have been ready, and it hasn't been ready. And the problems have been all from the Venezuelan sides. The Russians provided the machinery, provided the know-how. They transferred all the technological package to the Venezuelans. And Venezuelans weren't even finishing the buildings where all the machinery was going to be housed to finish up production, right? And Venezuela finds itself in one of the biggest ammunition crises it's had. It's now chronic. It's been going on for years. And they're still unable to establish those basic production capacities. So looking at Venezuela and the prospects of them being able to export military materials in the short term, I think are very low, just because internally they're facing a situation in which they're dealing with criminal groups across the country. And many times they have limitations on ammunition just with the rifles, and they can't get out on patrols because they don't have enough rifle ammunition, right? So I think, just to round it up, I think that support to either side in conflict in the short term is likely going to be very limited, whether it's because of the commercial implications being much higher than the political advantages of it, or just because there's a lack of capacity to become a reliable provider for any of the two parts in conflict.
Andre, I want to kind of ask a related question just briefly, if I may. Now, taking, of course, into consideration what you just said about equipment and not willing to do it for political reasons and simply for reasons that Latin American governments need to keep the equipment because they have so little of it. But a related question around support in a different way, support for sanctions evasion, aside from well-known collaboration between Venezuela and Russia on oil and in many cases evading sanctions around oil. Are there examples of countries in the region that are helping the Russians evade sanctions? You mentioned a minute ago off-the-shelf parts for drones. Russian production of some of its armaments requires components from the West, particularly electronic components. Is there any evidence of that kind of support being sent to Russia by any of the countries in the region?
It's not clear to me at the moment. I mean, a lot of these parts that we're discussing come from the commercial market. So triangulating them via one of the countries in the region could be easy. Logistically, it probably makes sense to just look for somebody that's geographically closer to Russia to be able to do this. Or even better, just look at China that has that production capacity to provide a lot of these electronics. I think that when it comes to the sanctions, we have to look more at the commercial side of it and how much of an impact these can have on the regional economies. Remember the discussions that we were having in 2022 regarding fertilizers, right? And what would mean if Russians stopped exporting fertilizers to Latin America? The impact it would have had on the production, agricultural production, mainly in Brazil and Argentina, would have been huge. Right in a moment where we were talking about what was the wheat market going to look like with the beginning of the war, right? So there's these specific items that Russia exports, and I think fertilizers is one of the big ones, but there's more, that make it very difficult for the countries in the region, especially the ones that have become increasingly dependent on these, to really be able to take harsh measures and accompany these policies that countries in Europe and the United States can or are pushing for, right?
Yeah. Elizabeth, Russia Today en Español and Sputnik Mundo have about 32 million regular listeners and even more followers than any other Spanish language international broadcaster has in the region. In emerging platforms like TikTok, Actualidad RT, they boast 2.2 million followers compared to, for instance, DW's in Español, less than 400,000. Russian private military companies like Wagner operating in Ukraine have been known to recruit from their networks in organized crime and from retired military across the region. How can Latin American governments respond to and protect their citizens from Russian disinformation and recruitment schemes in the region?
Yeah, so we can break that question into two parts. And I think the lessons I have here are, again, informed from looking at about 250 of these policies over the past couple of centuries. On the disinformation side, probably the best weapon a government can use is, frankly, using bad publicity, leveraging all of the stories that Russia very much hopes doesn't get out. So these might be stories of instances wherein we know Russia has hoodwinked Latin Americans who think they're perhaps joining for a rear area guard position or to be a cafeteria worker and instead has given them a one-way ticket to the front line. So be those instances of Latin American recruits or those from other countries, using that as a narrative to again highlight that not only is Russia duplicitous, but at the end of the day, you're just a body that Russia hopes will catch a bullet otherwise meant for a Russian soldier. And also in terms of publicity and using that to inoculate against disinformation, we say it a lot, but it is unfortunately true, human rights violations, saying that things like what Russian troops did in Bucha, those are what you as a volunteer from our country will be complicit with and potentially prosecuted for, either under our own legal architectures or those of the international criminal justice system. So that's on the disinformation side. On the recruiting itself, that answer is a little bit more nuanced, and often the most effective governments, when they look to kind of shape this behavior, they have to think beyond the context of a specific conflict. Prohibition definitely tends not to work. These blanket, you will not join, is simply not effective. Andre mentioned that there are 10,000 servicemen a year in Colombia who are retiring, and particularly with an excess supply like that, where there's a will, there's a way. Or in this case, where there's a conflict, there's going to be a foreign volunteer or foreign legionnaire. Instead, what tends to be more effective regarding this kind of recruitment, especially recruitment that isn't desired, is regulation and redirection. By regulation, what I mean is, as a part of enlistment contracts initially on service, as well as separation when you're preparing to transition back to civilian life, having clear provisions about what a retiring serviceman can or cannot do. Often this could be a private military company of a certain kind or a government of a certain type may not be allowed, and having that codified. Likewise for the broader citizenry, so not just servicemen who are departing, legislation with very clearly articulated boundaries of what kind of countries can be served or not. And importantly, this has to be talked about. So visible legislation, visible government statements from the Ministry of Defense. If the governments aren't talking about it, making these red lines known, their citizens can't adjust their behavior accordingly. But also redirection. And what I mean by that is using legislation and the visibility of that legislation to make clear who is and who is not appropriate for your citizen to enlist for. So those 10,000 Colombians who are retiring, they want to find somewhere to go. Saying you can't isn't going to work. We know that. But saying that these kinds of militaries are those NATO states or EU states or private military companies incorporated in these countries, making clear an outlet which is permissible can make convincing your citizens not to go the other route, the one you don't want them to walk, much easier to handle. Likewise, legislation in these kinds of service contract obligations can be very helpful in allowing governments to flexibly highlight a list of foreign adversaries, perhaps even an updated list, or countries with a proven track record of human rights violations, such as Russia, that they want their citizens to explicitly avoid. So again, we know globally that efforts to just simply prohibit this behavior often not only fails to work, it tends to have the opposite effect. So instead, governments, whether in Latin America seeking to deny Russian recruitment or to facilitate Ukrainian recruitment, need to instead shape the legal architecture and atmosphere in which they want this activity to occur, rather than simply hoping it disappears.
Andre, Elizabeth, thank you very much to both of you for joining me in this Twitter space. To our listeners, for more analysis on the impact of Russia's war in Ukraine, please visit the CSIS Americas program website.
And that's it for this week's edition of 35 West. We hope you enjoyed listening and that you'll stay tuned for future episodes.